Soul Talk is a podcast dedicated to making space for Latinx storytellers and content creators across all media to chat about their art, experiences, and culture. As a branch of the Soul Project, Soul Talk welcomes you to the Green Room.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Soul Talk. Welcome back to Soul Talk. My name is Joey Reyes. I am the associate producer at the Soul Project, and I am here with...
Hi, my name is David Mendizabal, and I am the associate artistic director of the Soul Project. And today, we are so excited. We are going to be launching our fall season, chatting with director extraordinaire Liliana Blaine Cruz. If you have not heard this name, you've been living under a rock or are new to the theater. But for many of us, we know Liliana as an incredible artist, a two-time Obie Award-winning director, hailing from New York City and Miami, an Afro-Boricua. her recent projects include Anatomy of a Suicide, which, fun fact, was the last play I saw before the shutdown at the Atlantic Theater Company, the incredible revival of Fefu and Her Friends at Theater for a New Audience, Brandon Jacob Jenkins' exciting new work, Girls, at Yale Repertory Theater, The House That Will Not Stand at New York Theater Workshop. Her first Obie was for her direction of the death of the last Black man in the whole entire world by Susan Laurie Parks. And she's done many more projects with many of her frequent collaborators and continues to be one to watch and one to... have a great time with.
Yes, and we are so excited that she is joining us here virtually, of course, in the safety of our quarantine during this time. That being said, how have you been over the last few months? It's at this point, we're close to 6 months now, half the year.
What is time? I don't even know. I'm like, what is time? I don't even know. Yes, this pause that we're in, I love it. You know, I love when everyone's like, it's just a pause, or like the theater was like, it's only intermission. It's only intermission. I said, let me tell you, when we come back to the theater, the last thing we're going to want to hear about is an intermission. I was like, maybe we'll finally be done with intermissions, because nobody wants an intermission right now. Anymore. No, I'm doing well. I actually, you know, I'm here in New York City, where I have been social distancing for 6 months, although I did just safely travel to Los Angeles for 2 weeks to do some sort of restorative healing on myself and get a little break before, you know, venturing into a fully remote fall on Zoom. So that was great to just have some sun, some driving, which I love.
Right.
I really do. I really love driving. And just, yeah, you know, get to connect with some near and dear friends safely.
Of course.
Out there. And with my partner, and just be able to you know, get some realignment going into the fall. How are you doing now that you're a blonde?
Oh, yes, yes. this was my special little, I guess, birthday present almost to myself, because I just celebrated my birthday recently.
Yes.
And in similar fashion to your LA trip, I took some time off from everything to you know, just be a human being, you know, like restore my foundation, and take time to be with close friends who have also been quarantining. You know, we like set ourselves up for success, I suppose, and how to navigate this new world, and rented a place, secluded, very off the grid. And when I say off the grid, I mean there was no Wi-Fi and no television at this Hallelujah. Place. But it had this beautiful patio deck, staying, like, just taking in the sun. And my best friend, who organized everything, cooked every single meal for us
for those
5 days. And yeah, it was just four of us having a grand old time and, you know, engaging in our deep conversations and our frivolous conversations and just remembering what it's like to be a human being.
Right? Absolutely. It's so essential. And it's so essential. And I just think, you know, self-care as an act of resistance, especially as queer brown people in this world, it's such an important act. And just a reminder that it's about the longevity of it, you know, and if you're not able to take care of yourself in these moments, you're not able to continue in the long haul of the fight that we have ahead of us to really dismantle the anti-blackness that is a part of, that permeates all of our culture and our history and the systems that we work in. And so, you know, it's a long haul that we're in for. And so that sort of restorative work is essential.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think what we need to continue to remind ourselves is that this is a marathon and not a sprint.
Yes, absolutely.
And take into consideration the ways that white supremacy continues to show up even in our virtual spaces. I know that, you know, over the last 6 months, I've had plenty of conversations with people and still experiencing, or now obviously it has adapted to affect us in other ways now. So I think it's just really important to remember, you know, like, one thing that I just can't have continuously been repeating to myself lately is it's about the journey, not the destination.
Absolutely.
A nice little reminder that just centers me, keeps me in the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, we are so excited to have you all back and joining us and for our revamped fall season. Stay tuned and we will be right back with director Liliana Blaine Cruz.
I can't wait.
Hi, Liliana, how are you?
Hello. You know, out here alive, gratitude for being alive in this moment.
That is wonderful.
You've got this like sunset glow right now and you look amazing. You're being outside.
No, I'm just trying to find little moments of light where I can find it. You know, there's a lot of darkness. So I've been grateful for things like sunshine where I can take it. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that's something that we've all been meditating on is like in this moment of darkness, of shutdown of our industry, of, you know, civil unrest, you know, where are we finding joy? How are we taking care of ourselves? Especially, you know, I think for many of us, you know, I'm not speaking for everyone, but believe that, you know, as an artist, we are activists as well, and we are part of the a key part of the revolution. And so it's like, it's not sustainable if you're going at 100% 24/7. You know, you've got to find those moments of respite, and you've got to find those moments of self-care, and you know, like you said, just joy. I've been noticing on your Instagram, you were posting pictures of like, I'm going on a bike ride, I got my hair done, I'm doing this, you know, hanging out with these friends, you know.
Listen, I feel like when there's so much in the world that's like attempting to like beat you down, to tell you that you're less than, to make you feel like your life is expendable, like whatever you can do to kind of nurture the creative, loving parts of ourselves is so necessary, you know? And like, we don't value that enough. Like, I think part of the fucked up, excuse my French, but like fucked up capitalistic notion is that we're only valuable depending on how much work we produce, right?
Absolutely.
And that's so deeply flawed. We are so much more complex. We're so much more in need of love and compassion, you know? And so I think that that first step starts with yourself, you know? Like, how do you treat yourself? How do you give yourself love when the world has told you you are not worthy of love? You know?
Absolutely.
And so like for me, like those bike rides, those connections to family, that connection to friends has been so essential and necessary, you know? And like, absolutely, this moment has been terrifying for so many reasons, but when you're searching for those moments of light, the time that I've had to reconnect with family, the time I've had to kind of reconnect with friends in a really deep way has been a lifesaver, you know, like has restored why I'm fighting, you know?
Absolutely, yeah.
And it's like right. For love, it's for family, it's for survival, it's for an appreciation of the beauty that exists in the world, and that beauty is in people fundamentally, you know?
Absolutely, mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, I think also, like, I was just reminiscing with Joey prior to bringing you on. I think that, you know, the last play that I saw before, like the day before it all shut down, was your production of Anatomy of a Suicide, so which was gorgeous. It was a gorgeous production.
Yes.
Yeah,
and you know, before that, there was Fefu, and there were all these shows. Mm-hmm. I saw Girls at Yale Rep. Like, you are just constantly working, and that reminder of that constant grind, and we're in these 10 out of 12s all the time, and you're in these dark rooms with only, you know, a few people, no windows, and it is, I love that, where it's like, it's a reminder, this moment of pause, to like really begin to appreciate the parts of your life that maybe you haven't prioritized, you know?
Yes.
And I'm wondering if there are any like daily rituals, or like, what are some of your sort of tangible practices of self-care that you've been employing that you would love to see carry on, even as, you know, things begin, you know, when, if things begin to open up?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so there are two that have been essential. Like you mentioned one, bike rides have been kind of essential for me. It's like one, like, going on the bike protests have been like super affirming, like riding through the city, like bike riding with protesters has been like an affirmation that we are not alone in the fight to kind of like change the way systems have been operating.
Absolutely.
So that's been kind of a therapeutic reminder of community and like a chance to kind of feel a sense of expansiveness in the possibilities of change. The other thing that I've been doing, which is kind of like, it's essentially like a meditation and prayer practice, is yoga, you know?
Amazing, yeah.
And like, right. I was like, spirituality comes in so many different ways, but I think everybody, at least a lot of the people that I've been speaking to lately, have been investigating what that means. Like, we've been in our quietness, we've been having to investigate, like, what is our connection to something bigger, like bigger than the project that we're working on, mm-hmm. bigger than the kind of immediate circumstances that we're in. Yeah. And I think that connection to the soul has been really powerful for me, and I feel like I want to like maintain that practice in a very real way, so that like we don't get kind of bogged down by the work, you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
It's kind of like tending, I use this metaphor, tending to a house, right? You know, you can work on everything that's on top, but if you have a rough foundation that's continued to be ignored, you're going to completely crumble despite everything else that you've been working on, you know,
exactly.
above the foundation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. And I think all of these practices, there are so many different levels of them, but it's ultimately about self-knowledge, right? Like what's going mm-hmm. on at the core of you, so that you can be kinder, gentler to the world around you, you know?
Absolutely.
In a space of understanding. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that's like, something that I've been meditating on is this idea of like how we show up for the revolution is really reflected in how we show up for ourselves also in a lot of ways. You know, if you're not taking care of yourself, you're not going to be able to, you know, that is an act of resistance, especially for Black and brown communities. It's like, you know, self-care as resistance, as making sure that you can really commit to the longevity of what we are entering into, this real sort of systemic upheaval and investigation. And so I think that, especially as a, you know, as what it means to be an artist right now when the field doesn't exist, you know, that's a great place to start. And I'd love to know more from you about what, you know, when people are like, what do? You're like, I'm an artist. And it's like, well, what does that mean right now? You know, or I'm a theater artist, especially. It's like, what does that mean right now when the field is is shut down, you know, and I do think that a lot of it is, like you were saying, like participating in these, like in participating in the revolution in whatever ways that you can, and everyone has their own part in the revolution, you know, and finding those ways that's going to really inform your own values, your own alignment as an artist, and sort of bringing that to the work when we can work. But yeah, I'm curious for you, like, as you've been sort of practicing these self-care routines and meditating on this time off, as you're looking towards the future of your work as a theater artist, what for you do you think it means to be a theater artist right now?
It's a crazy question. I mean, I'm teaching this fall, and it's kind of like, what is theater when we physically can't actually be in the same space together? And like, what does it even mean to make? What does it even mean to gather? Like, how do you describe what your process is? Like, how do you even begin to reconcile, like, how this pandemic is like affecting what it means to be a maker? And I guess the thing for me is all of those questions are part of the investigation, right? Like, I think like as artists, we're tasked to respond to that moment, to respond to like the atrocities that are being committed, respond to the ways in which we're asked to reinvestigate what it means to think about hierarchies of power, you know what I mean? Like, even to be a director, like, what does a director mean? When, like, director as, like, a field and a profession, like, started from an idea of, like, imperialism and colonialism and synthesizing, and, like, all of those things have been kind of reconsidered to be slightly problematic. And so, for me, like, as artists, we're tasked to take a moment to, like, reflect on that time, to reflect and to see and to meditate and to create in relationship to, in the midst of, instead of, in spite of. And so I think that's been really important to me, which is to take the time right now that we're in and really think deeper about what that means, as opposed to rushing to kind of produce, right? Because that's what our capitalist imperialist complex tells us to do. Like, we have to, like, make. And it's actually like, no, like, we actually have to be human beings. We actually have to see each other. We actually have to, like, wrestle with the complicated place that we're in right now. And so when I think about what theater is going to be, it's going to be in relationship to those questions, you know, like, it's like we're afraid to, like, be in a room together. So when we're asking people to kind of sit next to each other, that already is kind of like a tremendous, crazy ask. And like, so like the question of like, what are we gathering for? Why are we gathering, and what that means is like super, I think, essential in our investigation. So basically, I don't know. I don't know what theater is going to be. I don't know what it means, but I think it's like, this is the time to kind of figure it all out, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it makes me think, you know, even just talking about what you were saying, it makes me think that there's this really, especially in New York City, I will say, theater as a field as a whole is very capitalistic, it's very product, you know, driven, but especially in New York City, where it is sort of, you know, geared towards the commercial product, mm-hmm. you know, it's this kind of beautiful moment where it's a return to process. And like, not even like what, like not even process, but like we are literally having to process what is going on. You know, it makes me think of Jeremy O'Hara's Slave Play when they're like, can you stop using processing? You know what I mean? But it is, it's like, there's a lot that we've not been processing that we need to process now. And also think about a return to what our processes are. What are the systems with which mm-hmm. we've been making? How have they been inequitable for so many artists on so many levels, not just, I mean, racial, absolutely, but gender, sexuality, you know, economics, accessibility, like on so many levels, it's like, how are we processing the field as a whole? And I think, as you said, especially as a director, this imperialistic, you know, root, and how do we really think about that from a more collaborative, new paradigm kind of way. So I love that you bring that up. And yeah, it is. I think none of us really know. I'm teaching too. And I'm like, I don't know what I'm supposed to tell you because I don't know what I'm doing anymore, you know, and it is. But I think it's going to make for a really exciting generation of younger theater makers who are like, no, this is actually what's more important, you know, is this kind of work of really asking these questions and not just churning shit out that nobody wants to see, you know?
I mean, I think about that in relationship to folks like Fornes and like, and her legacy and like what that means in relationship to like, why was she not recognized at the same level as her peers? And I think we're in a space now where people are really like, no, like pay attention. You know what I mean? Like she was doing amazing things. And like our attempt, like particularly the younger generations, like attempt to like take accountability and to call out and to see and to recognize is like really energizing and enervating and exciting. And I was like, right, like we're recognizing those around us. We're calling out in some ways that ask for accountability at a whole different level than existed before, in ways that like people who are doing amazing things would slip under the radar, wouldn't be forgotten, are now being recognized and remembered and seen in a way that's like really thrilling, you know, and the possibilities and alternative possibilities of how things can be done and how work can be made and how like there can be cooperative environments in a way that like didn't think was possible before. It's like you guys are an example of that, you know, like you guys are doing such amazing, incredible work and you're like also providing like inspiration for the generations to be like, things don't have to be toxic. You know what I mean? Things don't have to be dark and evil. Like there can be like a multiplicity of perspectives and opportunities, and that's thrilling, you know, like we're actually working towards building the world that we want to see in a way that like previously we never thought maybe was possible. That's like the silver lining to me of like all of the darkness, is that like people are actively taking steps to change the paradigm.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I love that you bring up, you know, Fornes, and especially, you know, I mean, I know Joey and I, we were both so excited to be able to talk to you about Fefu and, yes. You know, I what a groundbreaking work that was on so many levels when it first came out, you know, on the level of just who the artist was that was making it, the characters that she was putting on stage, the form on a question of form alone and structure and audience engagement, you know, it's like, oh my gosh, this is mind-blowing. And the fact that it took so long for it to come back around, you know, and for us to be able to see this work that I think for many of us in the Latinx community, we recognize as this beacon in our, you know, limited canon of work that has sort of made it in that area, you know, and I think we all know and love it, but, you know, it was so exciting to see it. You know, I think we've all studied it, but no one had gotten a really chance to see a fully professional production. And, you know, I guess I'd love to know more, and Joey, I know you were really excited about talking about this too, is like, what was that like being able to go into this sort of iconic work that was an icon in some ways, and yet also no one had seen it, so it could be interpreted in so many ways, you know? What was it like bringing that to life in the almost four-dimensional way that you all did?
Mm-hmm. It was a little terrifying. I was like, Maria, I mean, Fornes, I don't want to like mess up your stuff, like, like, hey, ghost, like, mad respect, like, talk to me, like, tell me what you need, like, I'm just gonna try to be receptive to you. I mean, it was a combination of both playfulness, which she as an artist had in her work, but also a sense of like honor to that end as well, like trying to honor like the work that she did and the people that she inspired and the legacies she created, like felt really important to me, you know? So it was a kind of like wonderful way of like being reminded of the legacy and the people that she taught, like Luis Alfaro and Migdalia Cruz and Caridad Spitz. You're like, oh right, she was part of a community. She was part of like facilitating that community and advocating for the voices of that community. And that felt really powerful. And then thinking about how remain playful, because that was another, was just excited inside of the moment itself, you know? And so for me, like kind of revisiting this text that everybody kind of knew, which had its own stress, but also like nobody had seen was like how to stay playful inside of that, how to allow for the exploration and experimentation that she invited as part of the process into the work as it was being remounted. And that was a really thrilling experience because I had an amazing cast who were like open-hearted in that exploration. So I was grateful. I was grateful for that.
That's amazing. I'm so curious, having been an audience member and being able to walk through this show, not just watch the show, what was the rehearsal process like for that? First of all, how long was it? And what were the intricacies that you had to navigate in, you know, knowing that the audience was going to have to shift space and also listen in with technology as well?
Yeah, that was one of the things that we were really like, that we worked really hard to. One, like fitting all of the rooms inside of that theater was like a mind meld in and of itself. So I worked really hard with the set designer, Adam Briggs, yeah, to just figure out the floor plan of like, how are we going to actually make this happen? How are we going to get all of these people to kind of fit inside of these crazy locations? And then how are we going to make sure that like it maintained the intimacy that was kind of required of the piece, right? Because when mm-hmm. she originally did it, she was like in a kind of apartment loft space, and so there was already an intimacy that was kind of inherent to the location. And in this case, it was trying to figure out how to create that intimacy and yet at the same time kind of create a kind of semi-photorealistic kind of environment for the actors to live inside of. And then accessing like the emotional parts of the space. So a lot of like her interviews and a lot of the way that she talked about like these characters being kind of close, intimate friends. But then there's also the kind of like David was saying, like form of it, right? Like the house as a body in some ways, right? So mm-hmm. like thinking about where Julia lived, like in the original script, it's like she's in a closet somewhere. And we're like, right, why is she in a closet? Like there's something about it being forgotten. There's something about being lost. There's something about being in the depths of places. So to put her in the trap room was like in some ways a sense of getting a sense of her imprisonment, a sense of her like being looked upon, like the voyeuristic aspect of like in some ways that the audience gets to participate in that feeling of being the doctors that are part of her kind of mad hallucinations. And that that felt really key in thinking about the architecture of it. And so when we were rehearsing in a rehearsal room where we didn't have walls and we didn't have a trap room and we didn't have all of that, finding a way to facilitate the interconnectedness despite the way to maintain the integrity of their own scene, but also keep a relationship in terms of organic time to each other, you know? So they had to be able to feel each other without necessarily being able to hear anything. So for me, that became like a really kind of spiritual connection. You just have to sense the energy of the room in relationship to each other to sense that we're all kind of arriving at the same space. And that I think lends itself to that feeling of chance, that feeling of the greater spirit in relationship to our connection to each other as human beings, right? Like I wasn't gonna be like, okay, you have 3 minutes and 33 seconds to finish this scene in time for this person. It was kind of like, mm-hmm. guys, this is taking a little long, or like, why is that monologue lasting a little bit too long? Like how are these things connected even in their separate moments? And that for me led to a kind of more organic conversation about what was actually happening internally in the scene with the actresses and their ability to kind of listen to each other across space, which I thought was really exciting.
Yeah, that was so thrilling. And I thought there was something so beautiful. And you brought up Adam Rigg and, you know, Montana, and I don't, off the top of my head, I don't know the rest of your design team. I should, but I don't. But I know that, you know, the design was exquisite. I mean, I think that the design in your work is always exquisite.
100%.
Just like, and what an exciting, you know, talking about the house as a character, you know, oftentimes when you're designing or directing a play, it's like, great, we just have to make it like, where's the sight line? And okay, great, it doesn't matter what that back there is. But in this house, like as an audience, like we're literally walking through. So there were so many things that like, you couldn't see from the stage, but like when you walk around, so it was a full three-dimensional living thing that had all of these delightful kind of voyeuristic experiences for the audience, depending on where you were, like the sort of things you got to see, which I loved. And, you know, I know that oftentimes you work with a lot of the same designers. And I think I have had the great fortune of watching you in a rehearsal when we were at Sundance. And I know that deep, deep sense of play and just joy that is at the center of your work with your artists. And I'd love to know more about, yeah, like what the collaborative process for you is. It's like, as a director, like I know you to be not the imperialistic leader, but the really collaborative, joyful sort of party planner. And you bring all these fabulous people to your party and then like, it's a blast. So I'd love to know more about, yeah, what that experience for you is with your collaborators.
You literally describe my aesthetic, which is like party planner, fun times, good times. I mean, I think like the main reason why we like chose to participate in the theater in the first place is because like it was filled with like love and joy and playfulness, right? And I think sometimes in our self-seriousness as adults, we think like, oh, in order for this to be serious work, like it somehow has to be like lost, like in relationship to joy. Like it, like we can't have chaos, like this chaos that's surrounding me sound-wise right now. Like embrace it, embrace the crazy, right? Because it's all fucking insane. We're literally playing make-believe, you know? And like that for me is like the fundamental like aspect of making. It's like enjoying the act of creating together and remembering that like without each other, nothing exists. Like this universe only exists because we have collectively agreed to imagine this together. And isn't that fucking incredible, you know? I think the other aspect of like collaboration is centered around just having a sense of humor. Like we can't take ourselves that seriously. Like I just want to apologize to you guys for the crazy acoustics being back here that you guys are being so gracious and tolerant of, even after you sent me a lovely email being like, please be someplace quiet. And I thought I was, and then I just turned into a disaster area. So just let's acknowledge that craziness that you guys are being so generous about. Thank you. But I guess it's like, you know, like we have to, like it has to come from a place of love. You know what I mean? Like there has to be love inside of it, because that's ultimately for me anyway, like why I'm making work, because I want the world to operate from a place of love. I want us to see each other. I want us to recognize each other, recognize each other's pain, recognize the injustice that's happening, in the hope that like we actually can like make something better as a result of it. By wrestling with it, by questioning it, we don't just take it for what it is, but we think that there might be another possibility inside of that. And so I try to bring that into the rehearsal rooms that I work in the hope that like the practice of what I want in the world is operating in relationship to the world that I create inside the room with a group of talented, amazing, exciting people.
Yeah, I mean, I think even just, you know, there can be great control found in chaos, you know, and I think your work shows us that, like, there is such deep intention and specificity and detail, and sometimes you find your way there in the least likely of places. And I think if you go in too rigid, you wouldn't have that, you know, and knowing many of your collaborators, it's just you throw a bunch of delightful, curious artists in a room and you tell them to center joy, even when they're working on hard subject matter, and you find such a complexity in the work. I mean, I'm looking at your resume and I just think about everything that I've seen. You know, you've dealt with some heavy shit, you know what I mean? And yet when I leave the theater, I feel that sense of joy, and I know that the artists were taken care of, you know, and that you're not just sending them into the depths of darkness and then being like, deuces, do you know what I mean? You're really providing such a safe container for them to be their most vulnerable selves. And I know that, like,
thank you for, I appreciate you articulating that, because I think like we ask our performers, we ask people who are like on the stage to be vulnerable, to put their bodies on the line, to put their spirits on the line. And it's like, that's already so much of an ask, so much of a gift when they're willing to do that. Why not give them a space of safety? Because we can't, like, I guess kind of growing up, having watched other rooms and having watched like or heard stories of like super toxic processes, it's like, yeah, that's not okay. We can't be sacrificing people. We can't be asking them to actually hurt themselves in the name of art, you know? Like, if we're asking them to do the very like unselfish kind act of providing catharsis to an audience, then give them a safe space to kind of play and be human beings in the midst of that, you know? And I feel like that that ideology, that idea of moving past the toxic and moving towards the loving is starting to take hold now. Like, I think people are much less willing to deal with that kind of bad behavior in a way that I hope is like a positive move in our field towards caring towards each other in a significant way.
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, looking at the list of shows, I'm also looking at the list of institutions. And, you know, I know that those institutions aren't necessarily doing that work of caring for the artists. So not all of them, but many of them. And so it is, I think it's just beautiful. I love seeing your work because I just know that you create this beautiful world and bubble with your artists. I'm like, damn, I wish I was an actor. I want to be in a Liliana play. Do you know, just because there is, it's just, I want to be in a Liliana play so I can wear one of Montana's clothes. Like, I just want to be in that world, you know? So yeah, it's really stunning work.
Oh, that's really kind of you to say.
Yeah, I think what you're definitely highlighting, what's being highlighted here is not as complex as what people think, I think. And that's operating from a place of love, right? A love and passion. I mean, within that love, you find the abundance and the joy and the bravery for the vulnerability to exist in the room, in the space. And then it translates. David, you mentioned that in Liliana's direction, we're seeing that the performers are being cared for. I, as an audience member now, multiple times walk out of there feeling cared for myself, right? Even in dealing with topics such as suicide in Anatomy of a Suicide. It bewilders me at times when people think that operating from a place of fear allows to like pull greatness from folks. It's a mentality that I can't align myself with because I just don't understand it. But in my understanding of fear, you know, that's where we live in scarcity and ignorance, and we're not being able to like push past and move forward and intentionally create spaces that are safe for enough for people to be brave and to allow themselves to give over to this story and serve it in a way that it needs to be served.
Yeah.
I appreciate you saying that. I think, you know, when I make theater, I do think about like my family and like what my family is going to feel like. Are they going to feel welcome in this space? Like, are they going to be able to walk in and be like, oh, I can relax. Like, I know that this person recognizes me, you know? So like the boleros that I was playing, you know, and Fefu and her friend was like, for all the like, basically Latinos in the house were like, oh my God, my grandma played this song. Like, I know this, like, this is the music I heard in my childhood, you know? Like, there's something about that, like, it's about providing comfort too, because we're all taking this journey together, you know? And it's not to say that there aren't pieces where like the lack of safety is about the journey too, you know what I mean? Like Anatomy of a Suicide, you kind of already know, like it's about suicide. We're about to enter into kind of some crazy spaces. But the idea is that we're taking this journey together, you know? Like, that's the crazy thing. Like, guys, we're all in this together. Like, this is the thing, like, we're in this fucking pandemic. You know what I mean? It's like, you're not in this pandemic alone. You're not like, you know, we are all, this is a world dynamic thing, you know? And if theater does anything, it reminds us that we're all in this together. Like, we've agreed to sit quietly in the dark, you know what I mean, for an hour and a half. And we are saying that we are willing to participate in this act of imagination together. Yeah. We might have varying degrees of like the range of experience, but there's a communal contract. And like, that is so, we like so rarely have those moments. Like, or we don't acknowledge that moment. I think that's why theater is becoming even more so of a sacred space. It's because mm-hmm. it's one of those spaces where we have commonly agreed to participate in something actively together and place our attention on that. And I guess I hold that space really sacred, you know, and that feels really important to me. So I appreciate, you know, knowing that from an audience perspective, that care is felt, because that's part of the event for me. It starts the minute you walk into the theater door.
Absolutely. And I love that you brought up that this reality that we're not, you know, as much as media and as much as this isolation, you know, and sort of social distancing wants to make us feel alone, and it is understandable, many of us do feel alone, that reminder that we are all in this together. And if we continue to remind ourselves of that aspect of community, and in the way that, like in theater, like you just sort of beautifully said, like we made an agreement to go on this journey together, you know, just that perspective and that relationship that you have with your audience. And I love that you brought up your family, especially when you're doing your work, you know, because I think for many of us, you know, it's like we went into this field and our parents were like, why are you doing that? We're not in that field. So the fact that you are making theater and you're thinking about your family is just so beautiful. And, you know, I'd love to talk to you. You know, I remember at Sundance, I think it was when I was like, Blank Cruz, where does that come from? Like, talk to me about this. And you're like, I'm Boricua. And I was like, my mind was blown. And I was like, oh my gosh, you know, how did I not know that? I was like, my Boricua sister. Oh my gosh. And I'd love to, you know, hear more as a Black Latina, as an Afro-Latina, what that intersection of your identity is. And, you know, we've been having a lot of conversations at Soul Project about the lack of Afro-Latinx representation that we see, and how we as an organization, as an initiative, really need to like be engaging in those conversations, be really at the forefront of trying to shift that anti-Blackness that's happening in our community. But, you know, as an artist who is working at the intersection of many different identities, but these two specifically, I'd love to hear some of your thoughts and your experiences as a what it feels like, you know. How do you identify as a Latina artist, and the feel like, I know that's a personal journey that I'm still on, you know, so just curious to know about you and your experience with that.
Yeah, so I grew up in like New York and Miami, which are quintessential like areas of that mixing and melding and like the collision of lots of different cultures. And so being Black and Latinx was always, I kind of took it for granted until I lived in some parts of this country where I was like, where I was like, there's a possibility of multiplicity and experiences, you know? And I think sometimes like the way the media paints culture in this country, it's like we think everything is easily divided into either Black and white, or, you know what I mean? Like white Latinx and Black Latinx, you know what I mean? And I was like, we're all so interrelated and interconnected, and we just don't accept that. I was like, you know, like even in my own family, my Boricua family, you have people who like dark, 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 you know what I mean? And you have people that are like pale as snow. So for me, like all within the same sisters, you know what I mean? So for me, like the relationship to that interconnectedness was something that I took for granted, and I wish that more people would understand is part of all of our identities, you know, like we're all interconnected. There are Black people everywhere. There are, you know what I mean? Like we're all part of the story. And I wish sometimes that story would be told more often so that people could see the ways in which we're interconnected. You know, that's the thing that I feel like has been really important to me, like the intersection of culture and identity in a culture that tries to deny that connectedness, you know? And it's like, no guys, we're all family. We're all family, you know? Like, I'm your cousin. Sorry, you don't think I'm your cousin, but I'm your cousin. Like, that's the reality. So let's find more ways of finding that connectedness, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
I really appreciate you saying that. You're really touching on this point where I think personally, I felt like we were starting to in the old world is what I'm calling it, pre-COVID, pre-quarantining, we were starting to make strides into really digging deep into the intersectionalities of people's identities and sort of in a non-binary way of thinking. And then I think, you know, once everything started to shut down and, you know, we started to live in this new world, people clung to safety, right? And a very human instinct is to compartmentalize. That's neither good or bad thing. It just is a human thing. I think what we do with that is what ends up making it good or bad. And unfortunately, I think it brought, you know, it was like a two steps forward, five steps back situation. And so people are stuck in binaries again. And as a sense of safety. Obviously, like us as theater artists operating in this virtual world, now having to really be as flexible as possible, you know, figuring it out, emergence, you know, going with the flow, however you want to say it, trying to, you know, think even more outside the box than we previously have been. And then, of course, with the civil unrest that continues to go on, you know, making sure that we are trying to encapsulate everything as much as possible.
Yeah, and to love our dark black skin brothers and sisters and cousins and family members, you know, like literally, because they need to stop dying. They need to stop getting killed in the streets, like fundamentally, you know, like that.
Absolutely.
That's the thing that it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense. It violates our human principles, you know, on a fundamental level. And every time we ignore that or we try to act like it's something else at stake, it's like, no, we're killing human beings.
Yeah.
And we're all connected by that human family and it's not okay, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that is the ultimate priority right now of where we need to really be focusing, like you said, our love, our attention, our advocacy, the work, you know, and it is like we are all interconnected there, you know, like with everyone is everyone's cousin, you know, and in some degree, you know. And so, yeah, I agree with that. And as we begin to look in the Latinx community and the breadth of representation that actually exists. Like if you actually go to any part of Latin America, most of those places that you have seen on TV as all white are all black. Like that was my experience of going to so many places was I was like, oh, this is a black country. And why is that not the image that we're seeing? This is, you know, and we see that happen a lot in the media. And, you know, if we believe as many do, and I believe that, you know, our art is a mirror of our culture, what are the stories that we're putting on stage and what is the culture that we are continuing to perpetuate? And in doing so, actively participating in a genocide indirectly, do you know? And so it is, it's like, how are we really centering, dismantling anti-Blackness on all levels? And I do think it starts in all of the decisions that we make on stage, off stage, you know? And like, yes, it's just a play, but we all know representation matters. We all know, you know, the stories shift culture. And if we can do that, even at the microscopic level, the waves that can create.
Yeah, visibility and centering, like you said, are so key. Because if I had seen somebody like me at the center of stories when I was growing up, what a difference that would have made in my relationship to the world, in my understanding of myself, in an understanding of my own history, in an understanding of the world's history, you know? And I think this moment right now is not only about breaking down problematic ways of learning and what we consider to be valuable and a relearning of like the richness and beauty and texture and complicatedness of those that we have refused to see before.
Yes, absolutely. All of that. Just so beautifully said.
Well, you guys are amazing. I'm so grateful to just spend time with you guys speaking. And thank you again for your patience with my crazy surroundings. but I appreciate that. And I appreciate the celebration of Black people and Black people in the Latinx community, you know,
yes.
and the possibilities inside of that, you know, like our stories are infinite and that's mm-hmm. incredible, infinite and interconnected with so many parts of the world. And the more that we appreciate that and celebrate that, like the more love and possibility that can kind of keep resonating in the world. And that's my project, you know what I mean? That we can love more of us more fully.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just look forward to being able to see more of your work, you know, and see you leading more rooms and continuing to take over and, you know, acknowledging that even as amazing as your resume is, like I can see where those barriers still are. And to anyone who's listening, this is the artist to break down those barriers with. It is long overdue, a two-time Obie winning director and brilliant, brilliant leader and thinker and an amazing time. Like the amount of times you're like, let's just dance, let's just throw a party. And like, just, I don't know, in this moment in time, I think that's really what we need. As you said at the very beginning of this conversation, you know, you said we are just inundated with so much loss, so much death, so much grieving, and we're not in a place now where we can collectively mourn or collectively process anything that we've been doing. And so I just think as we begin to consider what it means to be opening up our theaters and what it means to be inviting people back into dark rooms to go on a collective journey together, you know, what a beautiful way to go into that journey again, to lead with love, as you said, and to provide spaces of healing and empowerment and visibility and just, you know, everything that you have been doing, the work you have been doing since the first play I saw of yours. And I'm just excited to see what you are going to keep doing. So, yeah.
Thank you, David. I feel really moved. As a fellow dancer,
yes.
And fun time experiencer,
you know.
I see you on that dance floor. I'm grateful. I'm grateful to be seen by you.
Before you jump off, is there anything that you would like to keep people on their toes about? Anything that you're working on upcoming that you can share?
Yeah, I'm working on this musical-based piece called Dreaming Zenzile, which Debbie got to see with Somi
Kahoma.
It's an amazing play about Miriam Makeba. And it's all about resistance and love. And I want people to think about that for the future. So it's a world project. And I feel like it speaks to this moment right now too.
Absolutely.
Amazing. Absolutely. And where can people find you on social media?
Oh my God. I mean, I guess I'm on Facebook and I got a website and I'm on Instagram, but you gotta search real hard and you might not find me.
Awesome.
LBCNYC, but you know, I'm not on there as much because I'm trying to like keep my brain open for multiple possibilities of Latinx. But yeah.
Absolutely.
Thank you
so much for joining us.
Thank you.
It's been so great talking to you, and we look forward to more.
I know. Let's all send some good positive energy to us getting our stuff together. Positive things for the election in November. Hope of positivity and hope for the future.
Well, absolutely.
Thank you guys.
Thank you so much. Okay. We'll talk soon.
All right. Bye.
Bye. Everyone, so we just finished our conversation with Liliana Blaine Cruz, and it was such a treat to see her and speak with her. David, how are you feeling?
Just always inspired. I mean, she is an artist whose work literally, like, I see her name and I'm like, buy my tickets right now, let's go, you know. Mm-hmm. Just because breadth of what she brings to the work, the visual storytelling, and the joy. You can feel it emanating. And mm-hmm. if you ever get a chance to just hang out with her, like it's real. You know, people who like just have so much joy to give and so much love. I just love that she reminded us of love mm-hmm. and of a loving ethic, and how if we really adopt that, we can really change a lot of the toxic behavior that our industry is unfortunately known for, mm-hmm. and doesn't have to be part of what our industry at all.
Absolutely. And the word that's coming to my mind right now is authenticity. The amount of authenticity that she holds. And I loved too, when we were talking about Fefu and her friends, how she referred to the set or the house that exists in the show as another character, as a body.
Oh yes. Right?
This like this beautiful, like, and how open it was, and like this I think the word you used was a voyeuristic.
Yeah.
I never thought of it that way, being an audience member. But I mean, I know for me personally, I'm definitely someone who, like, you know, something that maybe on paper can seem so mundane of like, oh, you're watching some people in a house, you know, mm-hmm. like what can come from that? But it's just the beauty that exists in the writing, as well as the way that it was shaped by Liliana, and that absolutely. Openness and that authenticity. And then the act, the performers were incredible. Like everything about that show.
Stunning. Yeah. Yes. I mean the whole cast, but I just want to give a shout out to Amelia Workman, who played Fefu, who just, mm-hmm. I mean, she, like, Montana did her no wrong at all by putting her in some of the most, and all of them, putting them in the most gorgeous clothes. But yes. Talk about an actor who could just carry mm-hmm. the scale of that performance and make it feel so inviting and so intimate. I love that Liliana talked about that, the intimacy with which they were still trying to maintain, because yeah. That theater isn't very intimate. It's so huge. It's so, mm-hmm. Cavernous in a lot of ways. And it's like, how do you create that sense of intimacy? And just, I think, especially thinking now in this moment of like, keep your 6 feet of distance away. Right. What a delightful experience that was to be able to be in community, sort of hovering with people, mm-hmm. looking at this performance happening below, and, you know, having such a unique experience, and like it's such a individual and yet collective experience happening at the same time, which was just so thrilling.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, how does it feel to be back with Soul Talk?
Exciting. I know, this is like our first episode. We've got a little structure this season. We're going to be rolling out some, you know, episodes on a schedule, you know, in a more structured way. I think it's, you know, it's really exciting to be able to be checking back in with these artists, especially in this mm-hmm. moment in time, and just hearing how they're taking care of themselves, what they're working on, how they are using their art and advocacy to engage with the larger social and cultural and political movements that are at hand. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm really excited. We have a really awesome lineup of guests that we've been yes. reaching out to, who, you know, are hopefully going to be available to share their insight, and just, yeah, being able to catch up. And I think, like Liliana said, you know, just remind us that, you know, we're not alone, that this community is still out there, and we are so deeply connected. And even mm-hmm. in this moment of social distancing and isolation, the community is strong, and we're there for each other. So it was so delightful to be back, and to be back with you too.
I know. So, we don't get to, like, I mean, I know that we're not, you know, in our typical studio space, but we like worked it out and figured it out to try to, you know, make this as original as possible.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know,
and as David said, we do have a schedule for the fall rolling out. We will be releasing episodes every other week, every other Friday to be exact. So make sure that you are subscribed. Be on the lookout for new episodes. We have an incredible lineup coming to you this fall, and we are so happy to be back. And with that, I think this is the time for us to sign off of our first episode of the fall.
Yes.
So until next time, thank you for listening.
Yes, thank you, and be safe out there.
Bye. Thank you all for joining us for today's episode. Make sure you follow Soul Project on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. On Instagram and Twitter, we are at Soul Project NYC and The Soul Project on Facebook. Our website is www.soulproject.org. Soul Project!